Now prepare yourself. This is going to be a really, really deep episode. We're getting into the billionaire owner of Victoria's Secrets, Lex Wexner, who at once claimed that he was possessed by a demon.
Proclaimed possessed by a demon. What's your secret to success? And he's like, I'm possessed by, I have a drive for more.
The demon that always wakes up in the morning with Wexner and tweaks and pulls at him.
We noticed the world of the djinn. He was heavily connected to Jeffrey Epstein. And just when he started to open up, this is what his attorney had to say to him.
Answer the question. Okay.
My guest is going to go ahead and break down what he believes was really going on with the material that was sent to Jeffrey Epstein from the Kaaba.
Jeffrey Epstein? This guy's been talked about for years.
Have you also heard of this redemption through evil? We'll get into the fake messiahs by the name of Zabati Zivi, who later became a fake Muslim. And someone else after him also claimed the same thing. And Jacob Frank, his successor, were both individuals who claimed to be the Messiah and who promoted this redemption through evil. These were promoting these satanic rituals like you're seeing through Jeffrey Epstein and the elites.
Are people still talking about this guy, this creep?
And for the sports fans, do not worry. We've got something for you also. We'll be also discussing LeBron James.
Fans, what message would you like to send for Israel?
Kevin Durant and much more on this exciting episode of The Dean Show.
But they've invited me and I've said, go, wait, come. And they invite me and every single person invites me every day to come in. And I love it. I love it. Am I going to convert? Probably, yes.
We need your support. We'll donate right now. Help us to finish and help us to get open.
Well, specifically, I talked to Ellie de Rothschild.
For any human being on this planet, nobody.
There's upsides to the children.
Yes, there's upsides to it.
What message would you like to send for Israel?
I've heard nothing but great things.
People who currently reside in the state of Israel are Ashkenazi from Europe, and they're not Semitic.
You go looking into this, you look at this was a pagan guy. It's mentioned in the Quran, actually.
I think he's a disgraceful, dishonorable person.
Pretends to be a radical African. Malcolm X would spit in his face.
These guys are investing in companies that sustain the occupation. They help. He does a Nazi salute. They didn't try to cancel Elon Musk because Elon Musk is their puppet and he's the fabric of the Kaaba. And I was telling you about, as if you logged in Jeffrey Epstein's Gmail and you were looking at the files.
But here, redemption through sin. This is actually, you're going to do sin.
Many of the soldiers going into Gaza, they wear like he's faking his Islamic beliefs on the outside, but inwardly, he's actually continuing to practice his beliefs.
A fake Muslim. Assalamu alaikum. With me, we have Ahmed from Propaganda Inc.
Yeah, Propaganda Inc. Co.
How are you? How are you doing, Ahmed? It's been a while.
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me, brother. It's good to see you again.
How's your Ramadan going?
Alhamdulillah, not bad.
You hungry?
No, actually, not
yet. Not
at all.
It's going good?
Yeah, it's going very good. How about you?
Yeah, I was, when you start. Getting into it. Yesterday I had a little bit of headache.
Yeah, the caffeine withdrawal.
No, I don't.
Oh, you don't do any caffeine?
I think it was maybe too much on the computer.
Oh, really?
Working a lot. Yeah, maybe okay. That's what. Or maybe, I don't know, but I drink a lot. But
I'm a caffeine guy.
Yeah, yeah. But you going through the caffeine withdrawal
now,
right?
Yeah. Today's not bad.
It's
but
not
yesterday,
bad?
First 2 days, yeah, it was bad.
Headaches?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Headache, low energy, can barely focus. Yeah.
Now
I feel great. Yeah. Alhamdulillah.
Alhamdulillah. So, man, there's a lot to talk about, man. Mm-hmm. There's a lot developing, and you are somebody who's taken a deep dive in many of these topics that we're going to be discussing. The current Epstein files, I want to get into the story. You were just sharing a really... it's a kind of a bizarre story, but it's a reality because somebody who you knew personally, and then we have the connection with, you had the Kaaba, you had the cloth of the Kaaba that Epstein was in possession of.
Right.
What's he going to do with it? What's he trying to do with it? But let's kick it off with this story that you were talking about. Just the average person and comes across these satanic rituals And you can imagine if he's doing it, what other people like Jeffrey Epstein, and then we're going to get into this false messiah.
Yeah.
And then we're going to get into the crypto guys and these other. We got a lot. There's a lot of stuff. There's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, there is. And a lot of it is quote unquote
Rothschilds.
Anti-Semitic.
We got Rothschilds. Yeah. Lex,
Lex Wexner.
Lex Wexner with the Victoria's Secrets. Anyways, a lot. It's mind blowing stuff we're going to be talking about. But let's kick it off with this story. It's very interesting.
All right. So before I share this story, which is basically about a satanic ritual, I just want the audience to understand that, like you said, today we're going to be covering a lot of different topics, from the Epstein files. Obviously, we're on the eve of a potential war with Iran. We're going to be talking about like mysticism, Kabbalah, black magic. We're going to be talking about false messiahs and crypto and inversion of morals in society, redemption through sin, active and passive attempts by, you know, the community to try and trigger the messianic age and bring about the messiah and bring about like just their selection, I guess, as like the supreme people, as the chosen one. So we're going to be talking a lot about a lot of different subjects. Some of them will loosely connect with one another, but we're going to start with this story of this satanic ritual. So you and I were talking earlier, and we were talking about the Epstein files and like potential satanic rituals, and you were asking me about the fabric of the Kaaba, and I was telling you about Suleiman Ahmed, who you recently interviewed on your podcast. He did a video, and he was talking about he was making these connections between the fabric of the Kaaba and what Jeffrey Epstein might be trying to do with it, like what kind of satanic rituals he would try to perform. And the idea, you know, with taking the fabric of the Kaaba is taking something incredibly pure. This is something that every time people go to Mecca, I mean, every day people are there sweating on it, crying on it, making dua on it, you know, just putting all their hopes and dreams and positive energies into the fabric of this Kaaba. And so it's, we don't believe there's anything special about that fabric. None of us would pray, but we would have a lot of respect for it. But someone like Jeffrey Epstein, who could believe in like Kabbalah or any kinds of other forms of mysticism, perhaps satanic rituals, he would see that as a pure object that he would want to be in possession of. Why? Potentially to do a satanic ritual. Now, people, when they hear satanic rituals, they think that, you know, these are either conspiracies, these aren't real, and maybe they don't have any real power. I don't know. I've never, you know, performed a satanic ritual, but there are people who believe in it and people who do it. And the story I'm going to tell you is about someone I knew who used to be a friend, is no longer a friend, who performed this satanic ritual. So this was a friend of mine who was high on shrooms, and he was experiencing what people call a bad trip. And so you know, he was like in a dark place, and I saw him, I witnessed him, you know, in this experience. And so I asked him, I said, what's wrong? And he told me, you know, I'm just thinking about, well, first he admitted, you know, it's like, he's like, I'm high on shrooms and I'm having a bad trip right now. Okay, why are you having a bad trip? Because I'm remembering something awful. Okay, do you want to talk about it? Yeah, sure. So what he ends up opening up to me, he tells me that when he was younger, and he was like maybe 29 at the time, 30 at the time, when so he was around like 26, 27, he really wanted to be wealthy and rich and powerful. Now, most people would, if they want that, they just go out there and get it. They study, they learn, they open a business, they hustle, whatever. For him, he wanted to take a shortcut, or maybe he wanted to work hard, but he just wanted some kind of help. So he decided to look up like these rituals, and he came across like these satanic rituals. And one of them was the process of taking a virgin's blood, right? Which you can consider as pure. She was a pure woman. You take her blood and you imbue that blood onto some kind of object, and then you bury it. So he had to find a virgin. And he never specified her age to me, so I don't know like how old she was, but obviously if she's a virgin, you know, we could just assume, let's just say 18. I don't want to assume younger because I don't know if that's the case, and he never specified. But he finds a virgin, and he, by his own description, makes her fall in love with him. So he fools her into sleeping with him, and that's how he obtains her blood, a virgin's blood. He takes her virginity. He takes his blood, puts it on an object, and he buries it under the ground. And he felt awful about that. And I told him, why don't you dig it up and destroy it? And he said, you know, I can't even remember where I buried it. And so he was obviously high on shrooms, but he was having this dark experience. And because he felt really guilty about what he did, not only to the girl, tricking her to fall in love with him and taking her virginity, but also just the act itself. He never ended up becoming rich or wealthy or powerful, and so he thinks, oh no, what have I done? You know, and so he was reflecting on that. And so I shared that story with you just as an example, like a real world example. If you don't believe me, fine, but I know this person. It's a real story. And they came across these rituals and they actually tried to perform it, you know, in order to obtain wealth and power. And so in the context of the Epstein files, this obviously, we don't know for a fact what Epstein was doing. A lot of it is speculation. There's a lot more files we need to get our hands on and see. But the idea for like why he might want the fabric of the Kaaba is for this kind of ritual. And we know on his island he had a temple, and on the roof of the temple there was a statue of Minerva, which is like this ancient Greek or Roman owl of wisdom, right? But there were other statues of like demons, you know. I don't know exactly which demons, potentially like demons.
You're talking about
Jewish folklore on Epstein's island in
Epstein,
the Caribbean.
Epstein island, the box that he had on there. That
he had like a what looked like a Kaaba, right? It was like a blue.
He had like the gold, the Masjid Aqsa dome.
Yeah, there was like a dome on it, which I think may have been added later. But basically, he has like this strange, you know, temple on his property, and there were statues on it and around it, right? And so some of these statues were like satanic, demonic, they're like Freemason or Illuminati type visuals or symbols. So for a guy like him, why he might want to have the Kaaba is, you know, in order to desecrate it, you know, to take something pure and holy like a virgin's blood or like the shroud of, you know, one of the holiest sites on the planet, if not the holiest site on the planet, and then desecrating it or doing some kind of ritual to it, and then hiding it, you know, in order to take the good, pure energy from it and invert it and redirect that because they believe in some kind of metaphysical assistance that they'll get, whether it's from demons or whatever, you know. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I was sharing that story with you.
This person, Lex Wexner, billionaire, CEO of Victoria's Secrets. He helped build the Epstein blackmail operation, I heard. Is that true?
So Les Wexner got Jeffrey Epstein started.
He got him started.
He gave him access to like control his wealth or a portion of it. He gave him apparently his Manhattan home, and he gave him power of attorney. Now, Les Wexner was like a billionaire, and at the time, Jeffrey Epstein, what was his reputation at the time? He was just a teacher, like a math teacher or something. So how do you give a guy like that, you know, power of attorney over you, mm-hmm. over your empire, really?
Why are you doing that? Are they family? Are they connected? This is my son-in-law, my cousin, my nephew.
There's no indication that they're related, but yeah, that's why people speculate that, you know, Epstein was serving some other kind of role, that his job as a teacher was some kind of cover.
Before I show you this next video, but you also reminded me that this Lex Wexner said that in an interview that he was possessed at one point by a djinn. He didn't say djinn, but we know that would be djinn, by demon spirits.
He said by a demon. He said that he was possessed by a demon called the Dybbuk or the Dybbuk. It was like D-Y-Y-B-U-K.
Yeah.
And yeah, he did an interview and he was talking about why he was so ambitious, because people who know Wexner know him as like a very hungry alpha male shark. Like, this guy is just so ambitious. He goes after what he wants and he gets it, and he'll get it through, you know, potentially evil means. And so he does an interview one day and he explains why he felt so ambitious, and he says it's because he was possessed by a demon in folklore known as the Dybbuk. And the Dybbuk, or the Dybbuk, however you pronounce it, was motivating him to just go from home to home and devour what's inside, you know. So he said this himself in an interview. You can look this up, you can find the quote. I think it was with Vanity Fair, but it could have been another publication. But yeah, he says himself that he was possessed by a demon, and then he purchased Victoria's Secret in the 80s from this guy named Roy Raymond, who Roy Raymond, when talking about his interaction with Wexner, who had purchased Victoria's Secret from him, he described him as like the literal embodiment of the devil. Okay, so imagine like you do business with someone and you sell your company to them, if you thought they were the devil, you probably wouldn't even conduct business with them. You wouldn't talk with them. So the idea, perhaps, is Wexner like bullied his way into obtaining this, and through his demeanor and his actions, caused this person to look at him as like such an evil character. Probably not knowing that a couple of years prior, Wexner himself said he was possessed by a demon, and that's why he was, you know, hungry to go from home to home or business to business in order to devour everything and take it for himself.
That's very interesting. So you got the former CEO of Victoria's Secrets, Roy Raymond. You've got it made. Victoria's Secrets owner, you got money. And then you got Wexner takes it from him, and now we got him in his own words talking about he was possessed. We say this is the djinn now, right? If he was,
yeah,
the world of the djinn. And now anytime you go down some of these rabbit holes, be it conspiracy theory or not, you always hear Rothschild. You hear these families, Carnegies, Rothschilds. So I want to show you this video and get your take on it.
Yeah.
Personal work for the Rothschild family in France. Well, specifically, I talked to Elie de Rothschild, and so I mentioned that earlier. And so he represented their whole families. There have been a whole bunch of people, most of whom I never would have met, but I knew Elie. He would say, like, I'm providing financial advice to the founders of Google. I'm providing financial advice to Jeff Bezos.
Answer the question. Okay.
So this was his attorney reached over and obviously he works for him, so this is his employee telling him he's going to unalive him. What are your thoughts on that?
How do you
interpret that?
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to interpret it. The first thing, obviously, you know, if you're a lawyer, the guy, he doesn't want his client to make this worse for himself, and then he's talking about how he knows this information about Epstein, basically. Instead of saying, I don't have anything to do with him or I don't know much about him, he's saying, you know, he's implicating other people, the founders of Google, Bezos, Rothschilds. Maybe he was trying to just cast the blame on other people's in order for people to stop paying attention to him. And maybe now they're just, oh yeah, let's look further into Bezos or the Rothschilds. But whatever the case is, whatever he said, his lawyer obviously felt like, this is not a good idea. Stop talking about this. Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like he wanted to, you know, he got really angry with him because probably going in, the plan was say very little. Like if you saw Epstein in his interview, he said, you know, my lawyers are telling me constantly plead the fifth, plead the fifth, plead the fifth. Don't talk, don't say anything. Mm-hmm. So he probably went in there thinking, hey, plead the fifth if you have to, if you do talk, but don't say anything crazy, don't say too much. And he says all this, and he's probably thinking, oh my God, I'm going to, you shouldn't have said anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, that's just a few ways to interpret it.
Wow. So what do you think becomes of this now? What do you think with all – you said possibly implicating people. I mean, is that something that from here, from what he just said, does it take off in that direction now? Or is – where do you see it going from here?
I think what needs to happen is they need to release the rest of the files. Because right now, I don't know if this was part of their plan, if they deliberately released all of this to just flood you with information, taking you in a million different directions. You know, one day you're talking about the Emirati CEO of DP World torturing somebody, and then you're talking about another Emirati giving the cloth of the Kaaba to Epstein, and then you're talking about, you know, George Bush Sr. someone to death, and then you have Donald Trump witnessing a baby get killed and tossed into a lake, and then you have...
That's all in the Epstein files.
Yes, but not all of it is confirmed. You know, like,
and you've been going through a lot of these. You spent a lot of considerable amount of time going through...
Yeah, like, I mean, there are good websites that have taken the information directly from the DOJ that make it convenient for you to look at. And so I've gone through the DOJ website, but I haven't gone through a ton of files. I mean, there are millions of them, and some of them are just... Like, for example, it's just like in sequential order, every step of the process for like the FBI first investigating Epstein at his Manhattan home. So one batch of the files are just going to be photos of them, like, okay, here's a picture of his door. Here's another picture of his door. Here's us opening the door. And like, taking a picture of like every inch of his mansion, and that's just one subset of the files. There are all kinds of files of communications, of testimonies. So when you hear these stories of like George Bush Sr. potentially raping someone to death, you have to verify, first of all, like, is that actually in the DOJ files? Because there's a lot of lies, a lot of manipulation, a lot of AI production, and there's disinformation. And so you have to actually go look in the DOJ to see like, hey, is what I'm seeing online consistent with what's actually in the DOJ website? So, you know, that's the first thing. But then even if it is part of the Epstein files, it's not like they investigated and proved that that was the truth. It's like they talked to someone, right? And that somebody said that that's what they saw, right? Testimony or that kind of interview alone is not enough to say, oh, that happened for sure. You know, mm-hmm. It could just been a crazy person they were talking to. But the point is, the Epstein files take you in a million different directions. Now, whether that's by design or not, I don't know. But what we need to do is to like dive deep. Every day, there's a new discovery. Why? Because there are so many files and they're unorganized. So right now, what people are doing are they're building tools, building websites, they're using AI, and they're manually going through every file themselves to try and piece it all together in a way that makes sense. And then through that process, that's when they're discovering more and more information about the Kaaba, about this, about that. And so I think that process needs to be completed, which is going to take time. And then we need to get the rest of the files. And I think there's a reason why Trump is like, when they ask him about the Epstein files, he gets so tired of it. I think it's because he just really wants this to go away. If there was nothing in the Epstein files, like he says, like he's been claiming, oh, there's nothing on me in there, but there's something on the Democrats in there, you know? Okay, if that's true, then why don't you just have the rest released, right? So he's obviously nervous. Other people are nervous. Maybe it's not going to reveal satanic rituals. It might just lead to like awful stories of corruption. Who knows? But there's dirt in the Epstein files. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're fighting so hard to not have these files released. And they're going to try their hardest not to have the second half. But we need to get our hands on all the files, go through it, take our time, verify what's true and what isn't, and organize it. So there's a good website you should check out. They take all of Epstein's emails from the Epstein files, and they put it onto a website called J-Mail.
J-Mail?
J-Mail. And it's like, it looks exactly like Gmail.
Yeah.
And it's as if you logged in Jeffrey Epstein's Gmail and you're looking at the files as if you were Epstein himself, the email. Mm. So, and they've organized it nicely. Like they have tabs where it's like all the communications with Bill Gates, all the communications with Noam Chomsky, all the communications. It's nice and organized. So any person can go check out this website for themselves. But there are a lot of other great sites too. I don't have their names, but I have the browsers open on my computer. And people are just, it's different attempts at trying to organize a ton of files. So
Let's go in the past now, because so we're seeing some of these things that are happening now in current times, but and then we can kind of get familiar with this history and then kind of connect it all together somehow. You have this individual that Zivi, yeah. He was somebody who claimed at one point to be the Messiah.
Yeah.
That we know is Jesus, peace be upon him. Mm-hmm. So he claimed to be the Messiah. And at that time, you had 50% of the people who believed in him. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about this fake Messiah.
Okay. So to tell the story, I want to tell a little bit more of some history and why I came across him. So if you're watching this, you probably have already come across Sabbatai Zevi, declared himself to be Sabbatai Zevi, yeah. He declared himself to be the Messiah. And he introduced this concept to the world, which would later be expounded upon by Jacob Frank, who also claimed to be the Messiah, of this concept of redemption through sin, performing evil acts to confirm or verify or trigger the messianic age so the Messiah can reveal himself so that he can reign supreme.
I want people to remember this term, redemption through sin.
Redemption through sin.
Yeah. So we have what's called Toba. Mm-hmm. As soon as you make a sin, you repent, you turn to the Creator, God Almighty alone. But here, redemption through sin, this is actually, you're going to do sin to get redemption. It's the opposite.
It's the opposite, exactly. Yeah, and this is being declared by the Messiah, right? Mm-hmm. This is supposed to be like the holiest, purest figure, and he introduces this concept. So why did I come across this? Because I recently did a video on Pax Judaica. People keep talking about this concept. What is Pax Judaica? So we're all used to the term Greater Israel. We know that the Zionists don't just plan to complete their conquest of Palestine and solidify themselves there forever. They want to completely dominate the entire Middle East and establish themselves, as the regional hegemon. And they believe that the borders that will align with their regional hegemony is biblical. And if you look at many of the soldiers going into Gaza, they wear like a badge a badge on their shoulder, and it's a map of Greater Israel, which runs from the Euphrates to the Nile River.
Yeah.
Right? And this is important to think about because we're on the eve of this war with Iran, where the Zionists have been pushing for decades, literally like 30, 40 years now, constantly lobbying the American public, Congress, trying to convince them to push the U.S. to embark on this very dangerous and destructive war, another war in the Middle East to destroy a country. And they claim it's in the interest of peace and security. It's good for everyone. It's good for America. But really, it only serves the interests of the Zionists. And so now this war might actually go down, which would completely solidify Israel's hegemony in the region because no one else would be opposed to them. That's not to say that Turkey isn't a powerful nation or Saudi Arabia, but Iran is, the only nation that at least publicly states that they are opposed to everything that Israel stands for. And so, and we know that they, supported proxy groups that, were resisting Israel in whatever way that they could. And so Iran is a publicly declared enemy, and they're the last one standing. And if Israel can destroy them, then they can solidify themselves and establish themselves as the regional hegemon. So now people argue Greater Israel already exists regardless. It exists by proxy. They have, like Syria now doesn't have air defenses. Israel can do whatever they want in Syria. So do they control everything Syria does? No. But do they have a lot of leverage over them to get what they want because they'll bomb them and kill them? Yes. So Greater Israel exists by proxy. So now people are talking about this bigger concept. It's not just about regional hegemony. The Zionists have a global plan for conquest. And this plan is described as Pax Judaica. They want to exert their influence beyond just the Middle East. They're now in East Africa, in Kenya, establishing Judeo-Christian alliances with Christians there. And they're spreading their influence there. They're developing relationships with Taiwan in order to gain leverage against China. They are, obviously we see the influence they have in America. So the idea of Pax Judaica is essentially the Jews are creating their own empire, and they're doing it on top of the American empire. And they do that by gaining leverage. And they gain leverage in a number of different ways. Now, in this explainer video that I produced about Pax Judaica, a portion of it mentioned the Lubavitcher rabbi, who many actually believe also was the Messiah of his generation, which I'll explain later, because when you think the Messiah, there's only one, and who the Messiah hasn't come yet, but believe in every generation there's a Messiah. Mm-hmm. And when the Messiah dies, his soul transmigrates from one body to another. And so they believe this Lubavitcher rabbi, who died in 1994, he was the Messiah potentially. He had a meeting with Netanyahu, and he told Netanyahu, you're not doing enough to bring about the Messiah. Wow. You're not doing enough to bring about the Messianic age. That's what he told him. Now, if you watch that, you think that's a harmless interaction. What he's saying is, you're not doing enough good in the world. You're not feeding enough orphans. You're not doing enough charity. But we know, when you talk to someone like Netanyahu, Netanyahu doesn't do that kind of stuff. What does Netanyahu do? Netanyahu performs acts of evil. He's constantly trying to oppress and kill Palestinians, produce war with Iraq or Libya or Iran. Netanyahu is an evil person doing evil things. So when he tells him, you're not doing enough to bring about the Messianic age, what he's really telling him is you're not doing enough evil. Or that's how I see it, at least. So now why do I bring this up? Because people, when they heard that in the video, they were saying, well, you need to look into to Sabbatai Zevi and this concept of redemption through evil, which is basically performing these evil acts to trigger their Messianic age, to rig it. So before I dive into Sabbatai Zevi, I just want to talk about Kabbalah, right? You have to go back like over 1,000 years for this, but in Spain at the time, you had Muslims and Jews living in Spain, thriving in Spain. And so because the were thriving there, their philosophers, their scholars had, time to produce other ideas. And they formed like what would become Kabbalah, mysticism. And so they were thinking about more about the nature of God, how God exists, how evil exists. And so they thought about evil. Where does evil come from? So they believe God created everything. So then evil must come from God. And that in the process of creation, God produces evil. And they have a whole complicated system for talking about the emanations of God, or like they have a tree of life and they talk, God is at the top and here are all these different realms with demons and good people and bad people and angels and whatever. Like they have a mythology basically. And at the bottom is, you know, humanity. They believe evil comes from God and trickles down into the human realm. And so that concept was introduced like 1,000 years ago, right? Very long time ago. Then what happens to the Jews? They get kicked out of Spain. There's the Inquisition. And now they're spread all over the world. And what ideas come with them? Kabbalah. And these ideas now spread and they become more popular in the Jewish world, especially because now the Jews have suffered another exile. Remember, the whole idea for Jews is that they're chosen by God, that they will reign supreme, that the Goyim, all of us non-Jews, will be their servants and slaves, and they will rule over us. And this will their kingdom will reign and rise in the Holy Land. That's what they believe. Okay, so if that's what is promised to them, why are they in Spain? Why are they in Europe? Why are they in exile all over the world? This is a question that's like at the center of many different theologians. And so Kabbalah was their attempt to like answer this question of how can we rectify this situation? So it becomes a concept of, and this is important to understand, passively waiting for the Messiah to return, being good, being patient, fasting, doing what God told us to do, and just waiting. And when God decides, then the Messiah will come and we will return to the Holy Land. Or actively trying to bring that about. So this is like the beginning of this concept of what is evil, where does it come from, and do we wait or do we take action?
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds of years later, you have a guy, Sabbatai Zevi.
Yeah.
And he's influenced by these ideas. And he decides that he's the Messiah. He declares himself the Messiah. And at the time, he's living in like Greece. He's living under the Ottoman Empire. So he decides, I'm the Messiah. And I'm going to establish, you know, our kingdom here on earth. And the Jews are going to reign supreme. And so he declares himself the Messiah. And at the time, There were Jews who rejected him. They declared him a heretic. And wherever he went, he got kicked out of those cities. Eventually, though, he was accepted by a popular theologian in Gaza named Nathan of Gaza. And he found Sabbatai Zevi to be very charismatic. And so he decided to support him. And he put his weight behind him. So now Sabbatai Zevi went from just this young, crazy guy claiming to be the Messiah to, imagine, like, if I declared myself the Mehdi and then you guys are like, you're crazy. But then Umar Suleiman comes out and he's like, yeah, Ahmed's the Mahdi, right? Everyone would be like, oh, yeah, okay, maybe, right? So Nathan of Gaza tells Sabbatai Zevi, yeah, you're the Messiah. Now half the world accepts him and become very excited. They start packing their belongings. They're like, get ready because we're going to go back to the Holy Land and Sabbatai Zevi is going to take us there. And Sabbatai Zevi starts becoming more and more bold. He even claimed he could fly. He's like, I could fly, but you guys aren't righteous enough to see me actually do it. Right? So he never actually proves he can fly, of course. So over time, though, he really starts to believe that he's the Messiah, and he becomes bold enough to say that he's going to overthrow the Ottoman Empire. Let me backtrack a little bit, because we're talking about redemption through sin. To prove he's the Messiah, he needs to convince Jews to stop practicing certain rituals. Okay, because the belief is that when the Messiah comes, a lot of the rules and traditions and rituals will no longer be expected of them. So let's say the Sabbath or fasting on a particular day. So in order for him to prove to people he's the Messiah, he needs others to stop doing good things. So on the day of fasting, he would say, no, this is going to be a day of feast, not fasting, feasting. We're going to eat. So he would invert certain things,
mm-hmm.
Right? Instead of doing good things, they would do seemingly bad things, right? So now they start rebelling against God, and they start rebelling against God's law. And who's establishing God's law at the time? The Catholic Church and the Ottoman Empire, the Khalifa. These are the ones who are establishing like a code of laws and ethics It's inspired by religion, inspired by God on earth. So they rebel. So Sabbatai Zevi says, I'm going to overthrow the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman emperor brings him forward and says, you need to convert to Islam or I have to execute you for treason. Sabbatai Zevi shocks the world. He converts to Islam. Now, there are who rejected him that said, yeah, see, you were a heretic all along. We knew it. Then there are who believed in him. They're heartbroken. Like, we believed you were going to bring about the Messianic age. So they're heartbroken. And then you have that say, no, he's continuing this inversion. This is part of the process of redemption through sin. So they convert with him. But when Sabbatai Zevi converted, he didn't really convert. He continued to go to the synagogue. He continued to preach. And so the Ottomans began to suspect that he's a crypto Jew. He's faking his belief. He's faking his Islamic beliefs on the outside, but inwardly, he's actually continuing to practice his beliefs.
A fake Muslim.
Fake Muslim. So he's faking being a Muslim. And over time, okay, over centuries, these people came to be known as the Donmeh. These are the followers of Sabbatai Zevi, who believed him to be the Messiah, converting to Islam, faking their religion on the outside, and never marrying anyone on the outside, being a very close-knit society and secretly practicing not just like rituals, but Sabbatean rituals, mm-hmm. right? Continuing this process of redemption through sin. And later, Jacob Frank, who was an Eastern European, he would claim that he was the reincarnation of Sabbatai Zevi and that his soul transmigrated from his body to
That's
his.
Jacob now.
That's Jacob Frank, yeah.
Jacob Frank now says he's the successor.
About 100 years later, he says he's the successor. He's the reincarnation, that Sabbatai Zevi's soul is now inside of him, and he's the Messiah, and he's going to bring about the Messianic age. And he takes this idea of redemption through sin even further. So now it's not just about, oh, we're supposed to fast today. No, we're going to eat today. Now it's, let's engage in orgies. Let's engage in sex magic. Let's have father-daughter incest.
Epstein-type
rumors that you hear, you know. Jacob Frank was doing this.
Because you mentioned these things that now we see are happening. Can you make the jump? Can you make a connection somehow?
You can't do it with confidence, but is it unreasonable to speculate that there are who believe in these, I guess you could call them twisted Kabbalistic rituals, because obviously Judaism is broad. We have to be fair to there are different ways to interpret their faith. But then you do have Alex Karp, the CEO of Palantir, who is a power-hungry, crazy guy who believes in anyone who stands in his way. Many of the AI tools used in Gaza to murder people, he produced, and he did so proudly. He believes in Kabbalistic numerology. Like, if he launches a product, or if he makes a donation, or makes an investment, he does it in increments of 18, because 18 represents, like, luck, good luck. For example, so Pornhub? He believes in that.
What the rabbi who runs Pornhub?
The rabbi who
Why would a rabbi run Pornhub? It's like an imam running Pornhub. I mean, you're laughing. It wouldn't happen.
Yeah, it'd be kind of weird,
right?
Yeah,
but and he has the justifications for it. Right?
Yeah, well, you know, it could be a good business opportunity, or maybe it's him continuing this concept of redemption through sin.
But
right?
You're a rabbi. You're supposed to be a man of God.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it makes sense. Redemption of sin. You're trying to push, facilitate these evils so the Messiah comes.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah. So we can't say that with confidence, but we can. It's a reasonable speculation.
So what happens next? So Jacob, now Frank, he comes in and all these satanic rituals are
happening. Satanic rituals, and eventually he also converts to Catholicism.
Okay.
And he decides to do what Sabbatai Zevi did. Sabbatai Zevi converted to Islam and could potentially undermine the Ottoman Empire and Islam by pretending to be Muslim, but actually being a crypto Jew who believes in redemption through sin. Jacob Frank potentially, you know, wanted to do the same thing, infiltrate the Catholic communities, infiltrate the church, and gain power, gain leverage. There are rumors, you know, Professor Jang has talked about this. I haven't seen any, like, academic evidence for it, but there's rumors to believe that Jacob Frank would eventually meet with this guy named Adam Wash, I can't pronounce his last name, but he founded the Bavarian chapter of the Illuminati, which was in competition with the Freemasons, which are these secret societies. And the Illuminati was famous for attempting to overtake the Freemasons. So they joined the Freemasons pretending to be Freemasons. So they were crypto Freemasons, but actually they were part of the Illuminati, and they were trying to gain leverage and take over entire chapters, which they did. Like, all over Germany, there were chapters that were Freemason, but that were actually Illuminati. There are rumors that Jacob Frank joined forces with this guy, Adam, to then gain leverage over the Catholic Church through the same process of infiltration as the Illuminati trying to take on Freemasons. Now, when people hear Illuminati, Freemasons, they're like, I can't believe these things are actually real. No, they're real. You know, you can read about it. There's academic work done on it.
But anybody who mentions it, a lot of time people are like, oh, okay, this is just another conspiracy nut. What are you talking about? You know?
Yeah.
So what do you say to that?
Well, you have to be reasonable and you have to be fair. There are some definitely exaggerations. Like, pop culture has taken the concept of Illuminati and Freemasons, and now they just blame them for everything, right? But what is the symbol of the Illuminati? The Owl of Minerva, okay? What was on Jeffrey Epstein's temple on his island? The Owl of Minerva, okay? So maybe it's just a joke to him, right? Or maybe he actually believes in these kinds of things. Maybe they believe in these kinds of rituals. Maybe these are real places where people gather and they perform these rituals. Mm-hmm. Like my friend who believes in taking pure virgin blood and imbuing it into an object and burying it for good luck.
Used to be a friend. Long
used
time.
To be, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
He's got rid of him. That's good.
Yeah. Well, he got rid of himself. He, yeah. You know, he had problems, obviously, and he's gone now. But
let me show you this other clip here, and it just goes to that mindset. And what do you expect in a dark world when you don't have, when you eliminate God in your life, when you eliminate any kind of moral code that you live by, and you kind of fall into these really dark things? Here's another person. You'd think he's an intellectual, but I want to get your feedback on this. And you think, wow, look at his mindset, what he's actually talking about.
Hmm. Everybody who's been attracted it into their life.
Anytime you're addicted.
No, answer this question. Everybody who's been attracted that.
1,300 cases of pedophilia.
And the children attracted the pedophile.
You really want to go there? Let's go. All these things that we label good and bad have been labeled good or bad depending on who you're taking sides with.
I have a really hard time with this. If I went home today and somebody was assaulting my wife, I would forcibly stop it.
Probably.
No, you would not value, probably. 100% well, certainly. I wouldn't say maybe this is his belief and this is my belief.
You're going to react in that setting exactly proportioned to your morality at the time. If you see what he's doing as evil, you're going to do what you can to stop him.
But it is evil.
In your perception, it will be.
It's not okay to beat a child to a pulp. It's not okay to sexually assault a child. There is something actually fundamental inside of us that is on a driving force towards life, love, freedom, the experience to live this beautiful world. And if somebody is intentionally interfering with that, we have an obligation to try and prevent or stop them. You can override your impulses. I've wanted to hit somebody and not done it.
You've repressed it inside yourself and then attacked your customers right here in front of me.
I'm attacking you?
Well, you're basically taking information that goes against what you say, and you're saying, I'm just going to refuse to put it on my show because of it. It's like a fight to you. It doesn't match your belief system, so you're ready to fight.
And your hands are shaking.
When you say that you're going to not go any further on a podcast because of what I'm saying,
because
that means it challenges you, and you're wanting to avoid it.
No, because it's putting out information that I think is detrimental to the world.
I'm not going to pacify my research. For any human being on this planet, nobody. The reality is that there's upsides to that event.
There's upsides to the of children?
Yes, there's upsides to it.
I think we're going to have to stop here, John.
Okay, so that's Dr. John Demartrini. Demartini. John Demartrini. John Demartrini, doctor.
I saw that clip. I almost couldn't believe it was real. I thought maybe somebody who was like AI.
It's real, right?
I don't know. It looks real. I didn't see any reason to believe that it wasn't. But because he's a well-known figure, this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So because I thought this was relevant because we're talking about kids, Epstein kids.
Yeah.
We've got the redemption of sin. All these like dark things are happening.
Yeah.
They're coming up. I want to ask you a question. Annually, what do you think, which country do you think loses the most kids? Kids go missing in the world, if you had to guess.
I'd probably guess the United States.
Because you know this, okay? Because you do your research. But what do you think the average person would think? Like, if you say, okay, kids go missing annually, what country would you pick?
Maybe Mexico.
Okay, Mexico, a lot of drug cartels. So you got South Korea, I'll round these off, about 26,000. Canada, 33,000. India, 90, 83,000, France 40,000, Germany 80,000 kids go missing, United Kingdom 69,000, United States 330,000 children go missing.
Over how many years?
This is reports missing children that came up in 2024. Mm. 2024, yeah.
Wow.
So now, for what he's saying, what were your thoughts on that? How would you interpret that, and what's your reaction?
It's difficult to do so because I don't know the context of the conversation they're having. These are, I'm assuming, highlights that were spliced together. Yeah. And so I don't know the full context of the conversation. So it's difficult for me to say with confidence. But
if you have people like this now who are thinking in this mindset, I mean, if you have... We have, last episode I talked about, and I think you said it was this proven Baal that was something connected to Epstein. But then when you go looking into this, you look at this was a pagan guy. It's mentioned in the Quran, actually, right?
Yeah.
In the Bible also. And talk a little bit about this, but then they would do sacrifice to this Baal.
Yeah.
And what was the, it's kind of the same thing with these satanic rituals with your friend. He was like, get this blood and do this, and then you'll get this. The same thing, you're presenting something, sacrificing to this pagan god, and one of the things was for power,
right?
For status,
right?
So now you're an elite, you don't believe in a higher power, or you've, you know, suppressed that belief, and now you are competing for worldly things. I mean, and the money is at your disposal, right? Stay away from the forbidden tree. Okay, eternal life.
Yeah.
I'm sacrificing power, maybe the whispers of Shaitan. Oh, you'll have it, you'll live forever. Mm. Just do these things. It just gets darker and darker.
I think one way to think about it, let's just think about how evil, like what we perceive as evil, how it manifests itself, I guess. How can I describe it? Let's just look at people who have attained a lot of success and power in this world. Mm-hmm. Let's just look at the Zionists. No one would deny that they have a lot of power, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do they obtain their power? Let's ignore the sex rituals and trafficking and all the, like, you know, accusations that people are talking about Epstein and things like that. They gain it through blackmail. They gain it through illegal activities, through cheating, through murder, through intelligence. It's all about the lengths in which you're willing to go to in order to obtain material possessions on this planet, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I could go out there and work, or I could just you and take your stuff, right?
Mm.
So, but we have parameters, we have boundaries. These are given to us by different philosophies, ideologies, religions, God telling us, no, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. This limits me in the material world, right? But there are people definitely who don't believe in these boundaries.
No.
It's about removing the boundaries.
Yes.
And tapping into this, we all have the capacity to do evil within us. So they believe in tapping into that, like, monstrous capacity to go past those boundaries and go to whatever length to secure more for themselves. And they view that success as the only thing that matters, because they don't actually believe in an afterlife. They don't actually believe in resurrection. They don't believe in being held to account. So the only thing that's going to hold them accountable in this world is anyone who has more power than them. So they're going to do whatever it takes. So when you think about these ancient societies, it's the same concept of how do you gain wealth? You conquer others. You take it from them, right? These are, you know, essentially evil acts. You can describe them. But if you're mystical and you don't have these boundaries given to you by God, and you're experiencing a drought, you're experiencing great problems, then you have these concepts of sacrifice. Well, we need to give up something we love, right? In order to please this God we believe in, like Baal, in order to produce some kind of change. But let's say you do a couple sacrifices and it's not working. Now it's about what lengths are you willing to go to? Our sacrifices aren't being accepted because they're not good enough. They're not pure enough. They're not young enough. Mm. Now you arrive at sacrificing children, the purest, most innocent beings. They haven't lived long enough to commit sins consciously, right? They haven't lived long enough to impurify themselves. So it's just this concept really of going to whatever lengths possible to obtain what you want in this world.
How do 300, over 300 children go missing? How? In the most sophisticated nation, the superpower of the world, how does that happen? How do you think that happens?
Well, we know there's a lot of child trafficking.
Yeah.
I mean, that Tampa, I think, was the trafficking capital of America, I believe.
Here, Tampa?
Yeah, I believe so, for a period of time. You can look it up.
Wow.
So there is trafficking for labor, perhaps for sex. You know, these are real things.
But
how 300,000? I mean, that is shocking.
But somehow the candidate now? Byron? Is it Byron Sanders?
For Florida?
Yeah, for Florida. The
African American who's running for governor, Byron Donald.
Somehow people, the likes of him and others, who are espousing that if we just get rid of Islam and Muslims, then our problems will be okay. This is kind of like the theme on many of these politicians, where we're talking about Epstein. You got a group of them, and many of them who come out and talking about the boogeyman, the buzzword, Sharia. What are your thoughts on that? You've seen these videos?
Yeah, I haven't seen these videos of Byron Donald, but yeah, obviously there are a lot of politicians in America who, why do they do that?
Yeah.
They do it because it's what the Zionists want. It's what the Zionists want. The Zionists know that their image is destroyed, and they want to protect Israel from criticism. They want to protect Israel from potentially losing support in America. And we know that they're trying to build a Jewish empire on top of the American empire. But if Americans turn against them and things become hostile for them, then they can't navigate as smoothly as they do. So they need to distract people. And people who might hate what Zionists are doing or hate what doing, they might also hate Muslims, because right now Americans are very upset about immigration. And so Islamophobia is like a powerful combination of the two, because on the one hand, it's addressing immigration. What are all these Muslims doing here? Let's send them back, right? But on the other hand, it's also these people believe something different from us. They attacked us on 9/11, blah, 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 you know, all the different stereotypes. So, but they do this to serve. Why does Byron Donald or any other politician say anything the Zionists want? Why do they deny that there was a in Gaza? Why do they say Muslims are the problem? They do this because they know that the power lies with them. And if they want to be successful career politicians, they need to serve them. And that should really tell us something if we're trying to understand where power lies. Because you can't challenge power and you can't defeat a power if you can't even acknowledge where the power is. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's why the Zionists are so obsessed with censoring people, because they know people are starting to identify that they are the ones who have the power. And so they want to silence anyone who's criticizing them, anyone who's pointing in that direction. That's why they buy CBS. That's why they buy TikTok. That's why they engage in censorship. That's why they go to YouTube, they go to TikTok, they go to X, they go to Instagram, and they identify certain accounts like mine and many others, and they say, these people need to be deplatformed. You need to take them off because they're criticizing us. So it's all tied together. Islamophobia is just, it's what the Zionists want. They believe that's how they'll protect Israel. They believe that's how, if they can just succeed with the state of Israel, then they will establish the Messianic age and they will produce the empire they've always dreamed of. They're the chosen ones with goyim slaves who don't have real souls. We don't have souls. We are satanic to them. And now the reason why I say this is because there's been a merger between Israel as an ethno-supremacist state, which started out as a secular settler project, right? Theodore Herzl, these guys were secular atheists. They believed in creating ethno-nationalist state based off their ethnicity. But they didn't have the numbers. In order to colonize Palestine successfully, they needed to reach out to the religious. While other religious, again, they have this dispute between, do we passively wait for the Holy Land or do we actively take part? They've convinced religious partake, and now it's evolved, and now it's no longer a secular atheist settler colonial project. Israel is a religious and an ethno-supremacist project, and there are rabbis themselves who say these things. Like, if you hear me say this, you might think, oh, he's just like an anti-Semitic conspiratorial person. No, I'm listening directly to the rabbis in Israel who are saying this, who describe goyim, us, non-Jews, as satanic, as their slaves. What do they say? If you're not a Jew, you're not even worth the fingernail of a Jew. That's what they say. They go into Palestine, they blow their trumpets, which are like religious symbols. They blow the trumpet, they have the menorah, and they wear the patches of Greater Israel. And then they go kill people, and they kill children, and they wear the lingerie of women, and they mock them. That's what these people believe, and they justify it through their religion. And the best example, of course, is Netanyahu on TV saying, "You remember Amalek. Who are Amalek?" This is in biblical scripture. They believe that Amalek was a tribe that tried to prevent them from succeeding and gaining access to the Holy Land and gaining power. So what did they do to them? They every single one of them, including their livestock. So there's a religious element to this, and that's why I and others point to this. But yeah, ultimately, like it's no longer a, I think, a like an unfair anti-Semitic conspiracy to say that there is a clique of people who are tight-knit that use their power, their wealth, and their resources to gain more power and wealth and resources because they have a vision for global conquest and domination. And those people are Zionist.
One thing I want to just point out is that how do you think when you really look at it from if you had family members, mm-hmm. grandparents, great-grandparents, and then the facts were established that these group of people, they actually, your great-grandparents and grandparents, they wouldn't have been alive if it wasn't for these people. These people took them in. They took care of them. Mm-hmm. But somehow now you made those people out to the enemy because our religion, Islam, doesn't teach us just to hate people because they're a certain religion, right? We hate injustice, obviously, like anybody would. If your own brother came into your house, your land, your own brother, you would fight against him to stop him from stealing your house, your land. But how do you think it's been flipped? Because historically it's been documented. You have people who come out, academics, say Islam saved the Jewry, the people. This is known. So how did we get to this point now? Do they know the history? Do they know that they should be indebted to Islam for actually, while they were being persecuted by the Christians, it was Muslims who they were running from the persecutors coming to Muslim lands and they were taken care of. They have safe heart. They were in safety.
So that's true. Muslims did welcome, especially after the Inquisition. They welcomed them into the Muslim world and they gave them like freedom and access that perhaps didn't have very easily or consistently in Europe. So they could work as a merchant. You could have a position in government. Salahuddin, famously, one of the most important theologians of the last 1,000 years is Maimonides. And he has written a lot of interpretations of like beliefs. And I believe he was one of Salahuddin's doctors.
Yeah.
Okay. So there are many who rose to positions of prominence in the Muslim world. At the same time, though, you still had, you know, you had anti-Semitic flare-ups for sure, you know. But it tells you that even though the Muslim world was welcoming, there are a lot of Jews, if you hear them talk, they speak very ill of Muslims. They say, no, they weren't good to us. They were horrible to us. They prevented us from, you know, the way they see it is if you're not their servant or their slave, this is not all Jews. Jews are not a monolith, just like no one is a monolith. But especially the ones in Israel, you hear them talk about the Muslim world. They say they were never good to us. They never cared about us. They prevented us from what? We prevented you from not having a state over us and ruling over us, and we're not your goyim servant slaves. Yeah, sorry. But we let you conduct business, right? We let you have your communities here.
That's being uncovered now with Tucker Carlson, who actually went down to Jordan. He's talking to the archbishop there, and he's showing how actually when Muslims... This is coming from Christians, and this is Tucker Carlson, and he's interviewing these. Did you see some of those interviews? Yes. And they're saying how actually it was much before 1948, it was much better for us.
Yeah.
That now we're on the decline, and actually the Muslims actually preserved our rights. We were actually it's kind of flipped the propaganda that you get.
Yeah.
Here, but then Tucker is uncovering a lot of these falsehood and lies.
Yeah. There's this British academic historian, Avi Schleim, I believe is his last name. He talked about, you know, because he's originally from Iraq. There are a lot of Jews who lived in Iraq and thrived in Iraq. Like you said, Muslims don't have any animosity inherently against other people. Obviously, there are moments in history.
Yeah, I don't want people to think, you know, because I've had rabbis on the show. I've had Miko Pilit. He's Israeli man. His father actually helped. He was one of the original signers of the Declaration of Independence, I think, for Israel. So I have Israeli friend and friends who are against this kind of oppression.
But of course.
What were you going to say?
What is it?
But what were you going to say then?
Oh, no, you're absolutely right for pointing that out. It's important because when you hear me saying this, you might think I'm talking about all Jews. I'm not, obviously. But the majority of the Jews are Zionists. They declare themselves a Zionist. They support what Israel's doing. And in Israel itself, you have religious orthodoxy that are justifying the Jews. You know, so we have to be able to talk about the actions and the beliefs and the behaviors of these particular Jews.
Yeah.
While obviously, you know, clarifying, which should be obvious to everyone, that we're not talking about all Jews.
Yeah.
There is a difference of opinion, obviously. But I would say, you know, the majority are Zionists and they hate us and they want to conquer us.
Let me, I'm going to get to these questions really quickly. This is interesting. 59 years ago, Muhammad Ali, he sacrificed the prime of his career rather than compromise his principles by standing against U.S. imperialism. American athletes today are cowards who are willingly participating in a genocide, what's happening, covered in the stench of atrocity and completely unashamed. So I want to see, are you a basketball fan?
I used to be.
You used to be?
No longer a fan of the NBA.
You got a lot of Muslims also and others who are basketball fans. I want to see what your take is on what this is. Probably one of the biggest basketball players out there. I don't follow much at all, but you're probably more in tune with these names and others are, and see what you have to say.
Fans, what message would you like to send for Israel?
If I have fans over there, I've never been there. If I have fans over there, then you know, I hope you been following my career. I hope I inspired people over there to not only want to be great in sports, but I want you to be better in general in life. So hopefully someday I can make it over there. Like I said, I've never been over there, but I've heard nothing but great things, and I appreciate the question.
Why are you laughing? Hold on.
I'm laughing because LeBron James is an idiot. I think he's a disgraceful, dishonorable person, but I shouldn't break my fast.
I hit a spot here.
Yeah. Well,
I thought you were a basketball fan. You're into basketball. Isn't he like the top guru of basketball?
Yeah, but he's an idiot. Okay. And he's always been an idiot. You know, whenever he does these photo shoots, he holds the book and he pretends like he read the book.
What book is he holding?
He's held many books, but they're like, you know, during whenever there's a flare up, you know, between the African American community or anywhere else in America with BLM riots, things like that. You know, NBA players would speak out about it. So LeBron James wants to show that he's paying attention and he cares. So, you know, when he does like a photo shoot or he's talking to the press, he holds a book, right? And he pretends like, oh, yeah, I've been reading about Malcolm X.
Okay, here he says, I see the book you're talking about. LeBron James is a Zionist cow who pretends to be a radical African. Malcolm X would spit in his face.
I think Malcolm X would spit in his face. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I say LeBron James is an idiot because he never actually read the book.
Oh, I see. It's the book. It's a book. He's holding Malcolm X's book. Now
his
I see what you're talking about.
Yeah, and the journalists ask him, what did you think about the book? And he can't describe. Because he didn't actually read it. He just goes, oh, yeah, it was kind of interesting. And, you know, he can't give any specifics because he didn't even read five pages in. He's literally an idiot. He's a performer. He'll do anything
for
money.
Now I see what you're
saying. And that's why, you know, he doesn't know anything about Israel. I actually believe if he says, I've heard nothing but good things, I think it could actually just be that he's an idiot. Mm-hmm. But it's also because a lot of these basketball players, first of all, 40% of the NBA is owned by Zionists.
Who's KD?
Kevin Durant. KDF, they call them now.
But finish your point, and we'll get to KD.
40% of the owners in the NBA are Zionists. What do they do with their wealth? They connect, of course, you know, a lot of the agents are going to be Zionists. A lot of the guys who manage the NBA players' money are going to be Zionists. And they take them on these trips, just like Robert Kraft, you know, owns the Patriots. He took Tom Brady to Israel to go touch the wall. The NBA owners of the Golden State Warriors, they took Draymond Green to Israel. And they took them on this propaganda tour, and you know, it's just to propagandize them because they want to take these celebrities and turn them into Zionists and make them basically PR agents for Zionism and for Israel. But they also, these guys are getting paid a lot of money, right? So that they're going to invest their money Where are they going to invest it? Well, the Zionists get them to invest in their companies. And so Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, these guys are investing in companies that sustain the occupation. They help the IDF commit their crimes against humanity. And these guys are investing in it. So these guys are in a bubble, basically, where like everyone around them, the owners, like the people who pay them, the people who manage their money, the people who negotiate their contracts with the teams, wow, they're all Zionists, and they are going to do whatever they can to help support Israel.
And KD, he's part of that?
He's part of that. Yeah, he invests in a drone company called Skidio.
Wow.
I think it's pronounced Skidio. But yeah, this is a militarized drone that has like thermal cameras, infrared. It maps out, like it can fly over an environment and have that environment produce into a 3D environment. So if somebody wants to family in a home, you know, they just fly the drone can map out who's there, and then, you know, they get an idea of where, you know, someone might be inside of a house.
Do you think this is a fair assessment of this word that you just mentioned?
People who currently reside in the state of Israel are Ashkenazi from Europe, and they're not Semitic. So saying anti-Semitic is a falsality in and of itself, because they're not Semites. The people of Palestine are 80%. They have much more ties to the Holy Land, so you could call them Semites, but the actual definition of the word Semite is somebody who speaks Hebrew or any Islamic language, so everybody in the Middle East is Semitic. Anti-Semitism is nothing. If I say I'm against the state of Israel, I'm not anti-Semitic. I'm anti-Zionist.
Yeah, I guess technically or semantically he's correct. You know, most of the Jews in Israel are Ashkenazis, mm-hmm, and we know that many of them converted, you know, in Europe, and so they're not ethnically, like, originally, you know, Semites. They're not, mm-hmm, Semitic people. So yes, but I no longer care to kind of like say, well, I'm more Semitic than you are. You know, you're the anti-Semite. We really have to stop caring about people calling us anti-Semitic. If I criticize Israel or Zionism because of what it's doing, I have the right to do that. First of all, as an American, I have the right to free speech. I can say whatever I want, even if you don't like it. Even if I did hate you for who you inherently are, which I don't. I make my judgments based on what you do. So, but even if I did want to be anti-Semitic or racist, I have that right to think that and to say that if I want, as long as I'm not acting on it or hurting other people. But the reason why we have to stop caring about these people calling us anti-Semitic is because we know they are crying wolf. They don't care. Real acts of anti-Semitism, they don't mind, right? Like if it's coming from somebody like Elon Musk, right? When he gets up, he does a Nazi salute. They didn't try to cancel Elon Musk because Elon Musk is their puppet and he supports them and he does whatever he wants for them. But if you criticize Israel, you're being anti-Semitic. If you criticize, you're being anti-Semitic. So they don't label this, they don't accuse people of this in good faith. They just use it to control people. So we have to just stop. We have to take away the power of that word. I don't care what you call me anymore, right? I'm going to criticize what you're doing and continue to expose it because I believe what you're doing is evil and it needs to be confronted.
You think there's a lack of consistency? Because when you have politicians who are supposed to be public servants, and I think recently now this was a senator said something in the lines of that dogs are more worthy than Muslims, something like this.
Mm. Randy Fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. So first of all, this whole thing about dogs is like completely invented. Like it came from Nordine Kiswani, who's this Palestinian activist who lives in New York, and she's
what was he saying about Muslims and dogs? This, I'm trying to find the quote.
Yeah, Randy Fine, he replied, he said, I would take Muslims over, I would take dogs over Muslims any day or something like that.
Wow.
I forget exactly what he said, but he's always trying to be abrasive and
but imagine if you put the word.
Yeah, exactly. But they don't care. They have a double standard. We don't matter. Nobody matters. Goys don't matter. Only matter. That's how Randy Fine sees it. That's how the supremacists see it. That's how the Zionists see
it. That's not right. We shouldn't do that. We shouldn't do that as Muslims or anybody. I mean, you should just not do that. I mean, but they seem like there's no consistency. He does it and it's like, okay. But imagine if that was flipped now. Yeah. So what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say that the whole story is made up. You know, yeah. Nordine Kiswani didn't actually, like, she made a joke because, you know, they're always talking about how Mamdani took over New York. Now it's going to become the Islamic Caliphate of New York and women will have to cover up. So she made a joke about dogs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She was poking fun at them and they took that joke and they, you know, lied and basically said like, oh, see, Muslims hate dogs. They have a problem with dogs. And they just use that as a rallying cry, you know, to engage in Islamophobia. And all of it is deliberately meant to simply redirect hatred towards Muslims so they can distract from what Israel is doing.
Okay, let's wrap it up here, man. We covered a lot. I mean, I think one thing that I derive from all of this is it's a very dark, there's a lot of dark elements that are operating. And for us as submitters to God, as Muslims, you know, you hear these topics of, I know for me, this actually increases me in my certainty, my yakin in this way of life, that I never want to miss ithqad. Never, you know, this is our supplications to protect us from these evil elements. There's so many of them. Why would Prophet Muhammad, there's so many du'as, there's so many, so much out there. And now for people like, oh, black magic, sihr, all this stuff, you see the people that we're talking about actively involved in it. And these are the elites, the higher powers. So I think for, to me, that's another lesson I derive. I say, wow, this is to be taken serious. And Islam gives you the answers how to take it serious. Don't miss Salah, be connected to your Creator. Know there's evil in the world. Look at 300 plus thousand missing children sacrificing to these pagan gods. Still today, the ancient people of the past are barbaric somehow doing these things, but you got people in suits now, elites, who are actively involved in these things. What do you have to say?
I think you hit it on the head. We as Muslims have to hang on to our faith, and our faith is what separates us from these kinds of people.
Yes.
God has given us the formula to be a complete person, to die in peace, and to prepare for the afterlife. So we need to hang on to that for our personal selves, for personal reasons, right? But societally, we also need to hang on to our beliefs, because we really live truly in unstable times. There's always been evil all throughout humanity. There's no reason to believe that this situation is uniquely evil, but I think we do feel that there's something unusual taking place. There's something very wrong. A lot of people believe potentially that, you know, these are the end of times. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of eschatological interpretations that are conflicting and competing here. You know, what the Christians believe about the end of times, what Muslims believe about the end of times. What people recognize is that there's a lot of evil in the world, and the world is heading in the wrong direction. And the only way to protect ourselves, to protect our children, is to hang on to our beliefs and to hang on to our faith and maintain a strong spiritual connection with the Creator, with our Prophet. And like you said, to do these supplications, to pray, to make dua. If you want good in this life, pursue it respectfully. You don't need a virgin's blood. You don't need to imbue an object and bury it under the ground. You don't need to commit. You don't need to kill or steal. Whatever you want in this life, you can have if you work towards. So I guess that's all I would say.
That's the beauty of our deen. Worship the Creator alone, not His creation. Be morally upright. Be a good human being. Mm. And we want the best. There's a famous statement by Prophet Muhammad. One is not a true believer unless he loves for his brother. An interpretation by Imam Nawawi, talking about brothers in humanity, sisters in humanity. You want the best for everybody, for this world and everything. We're not trying to facilitate these prophecies and whatnot, so, and spreading like this redemption of evil. This stuff is just sick and demented. It's beyond wild.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I want to thank you for going in deep and
absolutely. I'll have to come back, talk to you after I release my AI and the Dajjal video.
Oh, that's going to be interesting. Yeah,
I'll do an explainer video on that.
Yeah, let's do that. I look forward to that.
Yeah, we'll have to loop back up for that one.
Inshallah. Yeah.
But thanks for having me. Ramadan Mubarak to everyone listening. And Propaganda & Co. Check out my explainer videos. Check out my podcasts and my interviews. And you'll, if I wasn't very clear, if you couldn't understand everything I was saying, don't worry. I interview experts who can maybe do a better job, you know, from an academic perspective. So definitely check out Propaganda & Co. And thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you, brother. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.